Hello and welcome to the programme which looks at the Holy Land. I am Paul Calvert. Psalm 90 verse 1 from the New King James Bible says this, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations.
I'm with Jonathan Turner from UK Lawyers for Israel. Now, Jonathan, what is UK Lawyers for Israel?
It's an association of lawyers. It originally started as a group of UK lawyers, but now we have members and supporters from many countries in the world. And we use the law to support Israel and counter anti-Israel activity, including BDS and financing of terrorism and many other hostile activities of our enemies, including lawfare in international courts. And we also try and communicate to people Israel's legal case and the relevant facts, particularly relating to those legal cases, which are so often completely falsified.
Has your workload increased since October the 7th?
Absolutely. In fact, the number of cases that we've handled, or projects, if you like, has increased more than 10 times in the last 10 months compared with the rate at which it was going previously. And online appearances and on the broadcasters, my colleague Natasha Hausdorff may well be known to some of your listeners. She's an outstanding communicator, exponent of Israel's legal position, and she has appeared on numerous television and radio channels over the last few months. And we also do webinars and record those webinars and put the recordings on our YouTube channel. And those now receive tens of thousands of views each time. So the scale of activity is much, much greater. And, you know, we're frankly at wit's end trying to keep up. We have recruited additional staff. We were very, very small before. We're now a bit bigger, and we have lots of volunteers. But even so, we are completely outpaced and outgunned by the enemy activity.
Of course, people don't really understand the legal terms, the legal things, when they'll shout things like genocide. But, you know, legally, is it genocide?
Well, no, it's not. And one of the things that we did expose was that a lot of people were saying, and in fact, major broadcasters, including the BBC, for example, but many other broadcasters, said that the International Court of Justice found that there was a plausible case of genocide. Now, this was a misinterpretation and misrepresentation of a provisional order that they made in January of this year. And despite this being incorrect, it was picked up even by very senior legal figures in the UK who should have known better, former members of the UK Supreme Court, for example. They characterised it as finding a plausible case of genocide or a plausible risk of genocide. But we pointed out that that wasn't what the International Court of Justice had found. And one of these letters was written and signed by lots of people and sent to the UK Prime Minister, then Rishi Sunak, saying you must suspend arms controls because of the plausible risk of genocide. We pointed out that was all based on a misconception. And we were quite pleased to note that subsequently, in an interview by the BBC, the former president of the International Court of Justice, who had been president when the order was made and was the person who actually read it out and delivered it in court, said that, no, this was not a suggestion that we found a plausible case of genocide is not what we said. We said something rather different. And this quite clearly took the BBC interviewer, Stephen Sacker, by surprise. He recovered himself quite well, I thought, as his technique, his ability to, what had been obviously his main plan of attack, as it were, in the interview, was sort of completely knocked from underneath him. But nevertheless, that clarification really did vindicate what we've been saying. And is that's an example of some of the work that we do. So we do have very much these two sides, the explaining side, hasbara, as one would call it in Ivrit, and also actually invoking laws in order to stop BDS and stop funding of terrorism and stop discrimination against Jews and against people who, because they support Israel or whatever it might be.
Now we have a brand new government, and David Lammy has announced that he's going to halt some licenses for arms sales to Israel. Is he misunderstanding the law there?
Well, I don't know whether they're misunderstanding the law or whether they know perfectly well what the law is, but are deliberately taking a political decision. But either way, we are looking very closely at this decision and may have more to say in due course.
Mm. Now, we've seen demonstrations on student campuses. Are you helping Jewish students who are facing anti-Semitism?
Yes, we are. It is fair to say that it's often quite difficult to show a sufficient case in these cases, because the problem is it's the whole atmosphere created by these encampments is problematic, is hostile. And, you know, people say, well, no one's willing to talk to me these days. I've got no friends anymore because they know that I'm Jewish and don't want to talk to me. And it's all quite difficult, actually, dealing with that kind of thing. I mean, I do think the universities should have intervened to remove the encampments. Eventually, I think LSE was London School of Economics, was, although it has had a somewhat mixed reputation for dealing with these issues in the past, it was at least one of the first to obtain an injunction to remove people with a so-called encampment, in that case, actually inside a building, which makes it even worse and even more justified to have it removed. But they did do it and they did get the injunction, and that did set a useful precedent. But other universities should have got onto it sooner. I think Oxford let it carry on for far too long. You know, even if one takes the view that people are entitled to demonstrate and so on and to have some kind of, let's say, temporary presence, provided they don't actually obstruct people going into buildings and so forth. Well, in the case of Oxford, my information was that the information I was given was that it was a real obstruction to people seeking to attend the Radcliffe Library, for example, and various other buildings. And there was very real disruption of examinations. And actually, it was when there was disruption of examinations that the university finally said, right, that's enough, and got them turfed out. And I hope that the universities will, in the UK, will stop it, this kind of encampment, in the next academic year, starting late September or early October. And if they don't, we'll be on to them. I'm also concerned that UK universities might be giving in to some of these demonstrators, which in certain respects, notably in relation to investment decisions. Now, first of all, giving in to unlawful behaviour is a very bad thing because it only encourages more unlawful and intimidatory behaviour, but also taking financial decisions that may diminish the value of funds and are not supported by, and there's no consensus about them. Those are unlawful, breach of fiduciary duty under UK law. And potentially, if the investments are adversely affected and the pensions are adversely affected, universities could be held liable by the beneficiaries, i.e. the retired staff and their spouses and so on, who are adversely affected by it. So, again, we've made some representations about that to various universities. Again, as it happens, LSE have quite clearly rejected, I think, the efforts of the people seeking this divestment. But we are somewhat concerned about Edinburgh University and Aberdeen University and some other ones as well. And we will be pursuing that.
Are you able to hold terrorists accountable or supporters of terrorism accountable?
Well, supporters of terrorism, what we do is, first of all, we've complained about to the police and to professional bodies and employers about people who've expressed support for Hamas, because that's a criminal offence in the UK, expressing views supportive of Hamas and being reckless as to whether it will lead people to support Hamas. That is in itself a criminal offence now, because Hamas has been proscribed in its entirety as a terrorist organisation. But most significantly to date, and this is something that we were doing before October, but we are continuing to deal with it, we contact banks and other financial service providers, money transfer services and so on, who are providing services to charities or other organisations that are really fronts for terrorist organisations or just happen to donate money to entities that are controlled by terrorist organisations. And we have been successful in the past in terminating the funding of various organisations by showing either to the financial service providers or possibly to major donors such as governments. We've managed to show that they really shouldn't be giving money to certain organisations. And as a result, we've closed down over 60 financial service accounts of over 30 different organisations over the last 5 years because of links to terrorism. And this is very much ongoing business, but certainly we have had a certain amount of success there.
You've had some successes. Tell us about the Palestinian casualty figures.
So, well, we have drawn attention to our analysis of the Palestinian casualty figures and our examination of various reports that have been made. We held a webinar with two of the authors of one of the major analyses of these figures. And this was by Tom Wilson, Louis Stone and Gregory Rose. They identified major reasons for belief that the casualty figures produced by the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health in Gaza and the Hamas-controlled government Ministry of Information, we showed that they produced one of the major reports showing that these figures appear to be fabricated or manipulated or both, and provide a very strong evidence of that. There have also been reports by the Washington Institute and also by a professor at Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania. So, and by a number of bloggers, Salo Eisenberg, quite a lot of reports have been produced and very incisive posts have been made on X and elsewhere, showing all sorts of reasons for believing these figures to be completely unreliable. And we've analysed the problems in a detailed memorandum that we've put on our website and promoted on X, formerly Twitter, of course, and elsewhere. And we've communicated this to various decision makers and broadcasters and so on. But I'm afraid it hasn't yet had as much traction as we would have liked. But we will continue pressing on it. The analysis also points out that the broadcasters and indeed others, including judges in the International Court, and politicians frequently state the figures produced by the Hamas ministries without mentioning the fact that many of them are combatants who've been killed. And if the Israeli estimates of those combatants killed are correct, or even only three quarters correct, then possibly even if it's even less than that, still the ratio of civilian casualties to combatant casualties in this Gaza conflict is actually much lower than normal in armed conflicts in urban areas worldwide. There was an analysis done by the United Nations in 2021, or in respect of 2021, which found that the ratio was 8 or 9 to 1, 8 or 9 civilians for every combatant killed was the global average. And even highly organized military forces in circumstances where the civilians were able to flee to areas far away from the combat areas, notably the military action against ISIS in Mosul, the civilian to combatant casualty rate there was about 2.5 to 1. Now, in the case of the Gaza Strip, doing the best one can, it's more like 1 or a bit over 1 to 1, maybe 1.2 or 1.3 to 1. But that is half the level in Mosul and much lower than the global average. And this is testament to the extraordinary care that the Israeli armed forces have been taking to avoid civilian casualties as far as they possibly can, despite Hamas operating in, around, and underneath the civilian population in the Gaza Strip, and making it extremely difficult to avoid civilian casualties. Nevertheless, Israel's achievement is, by reference to what normally happens, extraordinary. And this has been recognised by commentators who are very familiar with the difficulties of armed conflict in urban areas, such as Spencer, for example, in the United States and others.
How do you fight BDS?
So we have a variety of tools. So first of all, public procurement, there are quite a lot of rules on that. And there is an international agreement. It's one of the World Trade Organization agreements, the Government Procurement Agreement, also arguably the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the General Agreement on Trade in Services, GATT and GATS, may also apply, but certainly the Government Procurement Agreement. And Israel is a party to that agreement, so it's entitled to the benefit of it. And this applies, but also either connected with the signing up to that agreement or separately, lots of countries do have legislation that prohibits or that requires procurement decisions to be based on purely technical and commercial factors and not on the basis of political considerations. So this is a major thing in the European Union, and Britain still has legislation derived from when it was a member of the European Union, implementing the European Union requirements, under which public authorities must take decisions on purely economic and technical grounds and not on the basis of political considerations, such as they don't like the political policies of, or indeed military policies of a foreign country. So that's one thing that we invoke. We can also invoke legislation on discrimination. Lots of countries have laws prohibiting discrimination. And so, for example, this is very much featured in academic boycotts, will typically result in discrimination against Jewish and Israeli academics. And also, we say in the UK legislation, one of the protected groups is philosophical belief. And it's been held that anti-Zionism is a protected or can be a protected philosophical belief. And well, if that's so, then so is Zionism, support for Israel. Mm-hmm. And so people who are discriminated against, academics who are discriminated against because they are supportive or sympathetic to Israel, we think that's discriminating against them is direct discrimination and is prohibited by the UK legislation. And for example, we had a student whose essay on, she wrote an essay on the crimes of Hamas against Palestinians, and it was failed because she didn't blame Israel for it. And we said, well, that was because of the discriminatory and racist mindset of the lecturers who marked it, and that they wouldn't have treated a student who held different or took a different approach to the subject matter. They wouldn't have treated that in a the same way. And so discrimination, as well as various other things, I mean, we said that the mark was wrong and negligent, and that the supervisor had told the student that she, since her essay was about crimes of Palestinians against Palestinians, she shouldn't go into the merits or otherwise of the dispute between Israel and Palestinians, which she didn't. And then she was failed precisely because she didn't. So we had a whole series of reasons, but discrimination was one of them. So we invoked that as well. And there are various other grounds, depending on the circumstances, on which we can challenge BDS. Divestment we can challenge on the basis of breach of fiduciary duty, because someone who's a trustee or manager of a financial fund has a duty to maximise the return on the investments and is failing in that duty if they fail to do so. And particularly if we're talking about pension funds, that's a very important duty, because if they fail to maximise the investment, potentially the beneficiaries, the people entitled to the pensions from their working careers, may lose out.
You are a charitable trust. Why do you do what you do?
Well, we have two entities. In fact, we have UKLFI Limited, which operates under the name UK Lawyers for Israel, is a company limited by guarantee. So it's actually not, strictly speaking, a charity, but it is a non-profit. And it's obviously not our objective to try and make a profit from this. And we have a separate charity which engages in activities that are charitable under UK law. So that includes some of our educational work and also our help for victims of anti-Semitism. So why do we do what we do? Well, it is out of a profound sense of a commitment to Israel, but also commitment to truth and fairness, because quite frankly, the way Israel and the Jewish people are treated is disgraceful. And just as people want to see a bit of honesty and fairness in the world, we do get very upset and concerned about the lack of that in relation to Israel. In fairness, I should say that whilst a lot of the people who do assist our organisation, the organisation does have a small number of paid staff. So it wasn't intended originally this way, but it has become an absolutely more than full-time job. And I have given up, speaking of myself and indeed one or two others, we have given up what would have been much more remunerative work in order to be able to do this.
Is the mood very scary at the moment for Jews? Are Jews fearful in the UK?
Well, some are, certainly. I think there is a variety of emotions. I would say that a lot of Jews are enormously angry about the position because, you know, we do feel that the lies being told about us are outrageous. And to the extent that we identify with Jewish people generally and Israel in particular, we feel that these are lies about us. You know, anyone gets angry when they are defamed. So I think I'll say this, that's probably the strongest emotion. But yes, I think quite a lot of people are very concerned, and other people are quite concerned. You know, I think people, younger people may be thinking of going to Israel, older people, you know, may perhaps stay, but we're quite happy for their children to go to Israel and so on. So I think it is eroding confidence of the British Jewish community in the future of Jews in Britain.
What's your website, Facebook page, for people who'd like to know more about the work that you do?
Yeah, so we're on Facebook, facebook.com/UKLFI. We have our own website. In fact, we have two websites, www.uklfi.com. That stands for UK Lawyers for Israel. So uklfi.com and uklficharity.com. And we're also on X, formerly Twitter, at UKLFI. That's F for Freddie in that, UKLFI. So you can get information about us from any of those. We also have a YouTube channel, UKLFI Charitable Trust, on YouTube, which you'll find easily in Google or whatever.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for sharing today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Pray that God will move by his mighty power in the Holy Land and bring his peace.